We're back in Arena A, or Arena A through Z, fighting for our literary lives. And we're talking to Benjamin Alida Sines. And as way of introduction, I'm not going to give you a formal introduction, Ben, because everybody knows who you are. They know that you write novels and you write poetry and you write children's books. And you're one of the most prolific writers I have ever met in my entire life. You come out with a book a year, just about, sometimes two books a year. And this year, you have Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, a collection of short stories. Why don't we just start off with you telling us a little bit about the collection?
Well, I didn't really intend to write a book of short stories. I was sitting in my house one day, and I had finished my new book of poems, and I was reworking it, and I just had to put it away. But it was more or less complete in my mind. And so I was looking for a new project, and I had several in mind. But I thought to myself, I don't want to commit myself to a project right now. Mm-hmm. And then I said to myself, I have not written a story, a short story, in 18 years or something like that.
You know, I remember that. I think I was living next door to you at the time,
right,
in our apartment in Sunset Heights, and you said that.
And I thought, maybe I've forgotten how to write a short story, although I teach a short story all the time. And I said to myself, if I can't write a short story, I have no business teaching students how to write a short story. So I thought I'd forgotten this art. So I wrote a story entitled, He Has Gone to Be with the Women.
I remember that.
And this story just kind of flowed. And it was published in Narrative Magazine. And the story also was selected as one of the top five, because they have this series on Narrative Magazine called Stories of the Week.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked the top five stories of that year, and that was one of them.
Well, that's not too bad for not having written a story in 18 years.
It gave me actually a lot of confidence. And so then I just started writing these stories, and I thought, and I talked to Bobby Bird, and they said they'd love to publish a, Cinco Puntos would love to publish a book of short stories by me. And so I wrote these stories, and each one of them has a scene in the Kentucky Club.
All right.
And I thought that would be a way kind of to weave the stories together because they're all kind of very different.
Right. Perhaps we should talk about a little bit about the legendary Kentucky Club on Avenida Juarez and Ciudad Juarez. Maybe not everybody has heard of it.
Well, the Kentucky Club is sort of a symbol or an emblem of the Juarez that used to be, when people used to go to Juarez and get dressed up and go to dinner and go to nightclubbing. And, of course, it's been a long tradition in Juarez because, you know, during Prohibition, the people of El Paso didn't have to worry about Prohibition. They just walk across the border and have a good time and walk back. There was a real nightclub scene back in the day. And then
and there it was elegant. It was
yeah,
an elegant
and it
scene.
Was, and you dress up. And I think that this tradition went on for many years up until the 70s, where I think in 1972 or right in there, you know, all the liquor laws in Texas started to change and every county could have liquor by the drink, which means they could open up nightclubs, et cetera, et cetera. And so everything changed. And so that people didn't have to go to Juarez to go clubbing because El Paso could have nightclubs of its own. But the Kentucky Club particularly had a reputation of people like to go there because they had this beautiful wood bar.
Right.
And they'd go have a drink there before they move on to other places. And, of course, during my day, that was probably the first time I ever had a drink at a bar, though I was not of age. So it's kind of a reminder in some way, a nostalgic reminder of the Juarez that used to be, especially before all this business of the right. the drug wars.
And there's also the legend at that Kentucky Club, a lot of the Hollywood people would come to Juarez to drink and to party and to get divorced and celebrate their divorces
quickie
at the
divorces.
Kentucky Club.
I've never understood the idea of quickie divorces, but Juarez used to be one of the towns that you could go and get a quickie divorce. So there is a legend, true or not, that's actually in the stories, that Elizabeth Taylor walked into the bar after she had a quickie divorce from Eddie Fisher and bought everyone in the joint a drink. Now, I have no idea if that's true or not,
right,
but it's one of those legends.
Right.
And it kind of suits the bar. Another legend is that the Margarita was
that's
a bartender at the Kentucky Club discovered or made the first margarita. Now, there is another bar in Tijuana that has that same claim. Of course, we all know it's the Kentucky Club.
Oh, of course. At what point did you realize in putting these stories together that every one of them was going to and somehow go in and out the doors of the Kentucky Club?
I think from the very beginning. And I didn't want it to be gimmicky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not gimmicky, actually, in the end, because sometimes it shows up only in someone's imagination.
Right. That's all. Or in conversation.
But it helps locate the stories in a place. Because everybody that I talked to, they said, "What's your new book?" And I tell them the title. And they all say, "The Kentucky Club in Juarez?" And I said, "Yes." And they smile. It's so interesting. And of course, if you read the book, the stories are nothing to smile at.
And the Kentucky Club certainly has this magic to it, that when you first come to El Paso, or when you think about El Paso and you think about El Paso Juarez, you somehow think sentimentally about the Kentucky Club. Like it's this, there's something magical about it. But during the drug wars, which most of your stories are set during the drug wars, but during the drug wars, the Kentucky Club came to mean something completely different. Can you speak on that?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about living on the border is that borders serve as safety valves for both countries. Mm-hmm. That in some ways, Juarez serves as an economic safety valve for the United States. You might say that about the maquilas, right? Mm-hmm. For our industries, they were able to do something in their country, which we can't do in ours. And that applies to business. But it also applies to our recreation. And so therefore, in Juarez, for instance, especially in my day, a lot of young men went there to be initiated sexually with prostitutes on La Calle Mariscal.
Right.
And a lot of soldiers used to do that as well.
Right.
And so it was a sexual safety valve, a recreational safety valve. And it was also that way, for instance, with the nightlife. And you can associate that as being something bad, because then we can say, and perhaps accurately enough, that Juarez is nothing more than a playground for Americans who want to let off steam. But I don't think it's that simple.
Right.
When I was a boy, I used to go to Juarez to get haircuts. My dad used to take us. And I loved going to Juarez because it had smells. You could smell all these smells. You had chickens hanging from, the markets. And you had all of these incredible smells. And compared to that, where I lived, it was like I lived in a very kind of antiseptic world.
Right,
because you go to the grocery store and you don't smell anything. You know, everything's wrapped up. And and I loved that. And to me, it represented something, I don't want to say more real. I want to say that they didn't hide.
Life and death.
No, they didn't. And then all the streets were alive with people. You know, Las Cruces was dead. There's people everywhere walking, doing business, buying, shopping. This city was alive.
Yeah.
So to me, it wasn't just this playground at all.
Right.
And I understood very clearly that there was a lot of poverty in Juarez, and that's not pretty. On the other hand, because I grew up poor, but it was a rural poverty, which is kinder, actually, than an urban poverty, I actually wasn't afraid of going to Juarez. I wasn't afraid of seeing poor people and all of that. And more than that, Juarez is so much more than a lot of poor people. There's a lot of rich people there, too.
There's
a little bit of everything. So I came to understand Juarez, when I came of age into adulthood, as a very complex place. And I love the complexity of it. I never pretended to understand all of Juarez because I'm not from there. But on the other hand, I'm more than just a visitor. To me, it really is home. Right. I cannot imagine El Paso without Juarez.
Right.
I can't. This city, as far as I am concerned, would not exist as the El Paso we know if Juarez wasn't there. So it has really helped to define and shape this city and this border and who I am.
And when the drug war started, Juarez became the myrtle capital of the world. And most of the, like you said, most of your stories are set during that time. Kentucky Club became a safe place. People wouldn't go to the mercados anymore, especially the tourist mercados. They kind of went out of business. So many things went out of business. So many restaurants. Martino's, one of the most iconic restaurants in all of Juarez, went out of business. But people would still go to the Kentucky Club, and they would feel safe there. And it was a refuge. And what was the interesting thing about it also is that all walks of life were in there. Kids coming over to get drunk, Mexican couples sitting at the edge of the bar flirting, business people, journalists.
Ordinary citizens of Juarez.
Right, right.
All the different worlds collide. They meet. They don't just clash. They also embrace.
You know, it's like everything begins and ends at the Kentucky Club. So it was a very apt title. There's seven stories in this. He Has Gone to Be with the Women is the first story. And as you said, that was the story you decided you were going to just try to write a short story, see if you could do it. And then you got into Narrative Magazine. But when I reached the end of the story and it was revealed the meaning of that title, it gave me chills. It blew me away. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's a difficult story to talk about. I know a lot of people tell me, including our producer Norma Martinez, says that they can really hear me. It's as if it's me. And it's not, but it must be.
Right.
I just started writing a story, and it was the first story I ever wrote that was a love story between two men.
Right.
I'd never written that.
Was this before Aristotle and Dante discovered the secrets of the universe?
Yes, I wrote the story before.
That was your YA novel where one of the characters
falls in love with another boy. And maybe that's the story that sounds more like my voice because I wanted to claim that. But it's very natural. It's just about two men who kind of notice each other. And they notice each other for a couple of years.
One of them goes to Starbucks every Sunday, not to get coffee, but to buy the
New York Times.
And the other one notices him, which really I think is an interesting way for them to meet. And they kind of fall in love. They have a relationship. But tell me about that title, He Has Gone to Be with the Women, and if you don't mind, what it really means. It ties the entire story together. I don't want to, you know, do a spoiler alert.
Okay. I'm going to try to talk about it so as not to ruin the ending. The women that the title refers to are the women that were killed in what we often call the femicide in Juarez. And how I tie the story and one of the characters to that is, in fact, where the title comes from. And I hint at tragedy at the very beginning of the story when the character who is telling the story in the first person notices what his future lover reads. And he notices that he reads Kazantzakis, he reads Faulkner, and he reads, I forget which other writer. Mm. But anyway, they're all tragic writers.
Right.
And so I hint at that from the very beginning. And I have never really ever written a love story, not really.
Right.
And so the story's long, as all my stories are, so they tend to be novels. In some ways, they feel like novels.
Right, right.
They feel that way. They're just longer short stories because I'm quite unable to write short stories.
You're not a flash fiction kind of fiction writer.
No, because I tend to think that I am a novelist at heart. And therefore, if I'm going to write short stories, it's going to necessitate that my stories be longer. And I'm not going to shy away from that.
Right.
That means that sometimes they won't be published in literary magazines because they're too long for them, but I don't worry about that.
Right. We're talking to Benjamin Alida Sines, whose new book, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, just came out. I would say that this book in general, because, you know, many of the relationships that develop are between two men or between two boys, perhaps allowed you to speak about romantic love in a more authentic way than you were able to before. There's a character in here in the story called Sometimes the Rain.
Sometimes the Rain.
And the main character is this young man, precocious. He likes to read. And he's attracted to a girl that he's been in a relationship with, but there's really no passion in his attraction to her. It's more just his expectations and his friendship with her, and he loves her, but there really is no true passion or for him romantically until he is able to express it to his love for a boy.
I think I would put it this way. I think that this book of short stories and my young adult novel, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, I think I gave myself a gift that I needed to give myself. I have always been the kind of writer who writes at the time whatever book I'm writing. That's the book I need to write. It's the book if I don't need to write it, I'm not going to write it, mm-hmm. because that's just the way I work. I used to think that writing was all about craft, that it was all about knowing all the strategies available to you as a writer and how you employ or deploy those, everything you know about the technical, all the technical elements of writing, form, techniques, et cetera, and all you have to do then is know those, know how to write mm-hmm. a good sentence that's accurate and sometimes pure, and then find a good story and do it. That may be true to an extent for all writers, but that doesn't make you a writer.
Right.
Just because you know plumbing doesn't mean you know how to build a house.
Right.
I know now for me that I can only write things that I need to write. And that means that writing for me has always been therapeutic. And it sounds...
You're fighting for your life. You're in the arena fighting for your life.
Writing has always saved my life. It has saved my life. I know that if I didn't have writing in my life, I'm not sure that I would be alive today.
I think this book takes you to another level. And I think it's not just the sexuality, but it's also, you've often written about addiction, about your characters addicted to cocaine or addicted to alcohol. But these characters are much, much more... There's much more detail about addiction, and side by side with the drug wars going on, you have a story of a man and his son, and he dies. He dies of his addiction. It eventually overtakes him, and you have others that are just the brother and sister, where the sister gets addicted to meth, and all this in the background of the drug wars.
Well, I think it's because we always speak of drugs. And this whole thing called the drug war, I think it's much more complicated than that. You know, like I have to say, I feel almost sometimes uncomfortable using what's going on in Mexico right now as simply a matter of the drug wars. It's right. Shorthand for a lot of stuff. So we'll use that term. But I think I wanted to write, so much has been written about all what's going on. So I wanted to write something about from the perspective of the actual users, the market. This is the market for. If there's a market for drugs, it's people.
And as you point out, it's not just poor people.
No, it's not just poor people.
It's people with addictive personalities come from all walks of life. You have lawyers here.
Yes, there's an attorney in one of the stories, in the last story, and he is an addict. And his boyfriend doesn't know it and only discovers this after a long period of time because this attorney does not do this in front of him, but when he's away from him. But there are consequences to drugs, and the consequences have a high human cost because it can destroy people's lives. And it does destroy people's lives. And it hurts people, and it hurts the people around them. And it's really difficult. These issues are not, they're not just matters of the law and our laws. They're about human beings. And they're about human beings who are looking for things perhaps in their lives because there's something missing. And so many people, me included, go looking for salvation in all the wrong places. Right. And that's what I write about. In fact, that's what I've always written about. Now it's just focused in a different way. Yeah. I always think that all of my characters and all of my work, they're people who are looking for a way out of their circumstance. And that is also what you write about.
Right. Do you think that writers are vulnerable to addiction of things that are destructive, like drugs or sex or, you know, whatever it is, suicide, thoughts of suicide, that they're really vulnerable to it? And that's why for artists, the work itself, the writing, the arena within which they work is their salvation?
No, I would say this. I think that if you really want to be a good artist, and of course all writers and all artists, they don't just want to be good, they want to be great. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean that we have greatness in us, but we mm-hmm. want that. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, that means you really have to push the envelope. You have to. You really have to. And when you're doing that, when you're really trying to, I don't want to say gamble, to take risks, to take aesthetic and or emotional risks, that means that you sometimes do that also with your life.
Right.
You don't have to. You don't have to. But some of us do. And there's a price to be paid for that. So I think that, yeah, it's not surprising, because what happens when you're really pushing to do really good or the greatest work you can do, that means that it hurts.
Mm.
And it has to hurt. And there is some suffering involved. And that sounds weird to say, because some people suffer because they're victims.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not victims. We may be, though, victims of our own ambition or our own psychology.
That reminds me of something you said right after Last Night I Sang to the Monster came out. You were doing a presentation, and you said that if what you write doesn't hurt, it's not worth writing. And that really struck me, because it made me look at everything I've been writing and saying, did this hurt me? It explained a lot of things. And I imagine this book hurt.
Yes, but I think always in my life, it does hurt. I don't mind it. I do not mind it. You know, pain is not something we ought to run away from. Pain is something that we need to confront and understand. And that's really very difficult, because that also means that you have to start, you hope to live your life with honesty. And I'm going to tell you something. It's very difficult to live with your life and be honest, because we live in a culture that teaches us how to lie. Mm-hmm. And we live in a culture, and in our relationships, we are almost taught or expected to withhold our emotions and to say really what we feel. So we spend our lives dancing around all of that. Mm-hmm. And at least if I can't do that in my life, even though I'm trying, I can do that in my work.
I want to ask you about Chasing the Dragon. That's the penultimate story, and it's a story about a brother and a sister. And the sister gets addicted to meth. She ends up going deeper and deeper into her addiction. And she talks about the term chasing the dragon, which is chasing that first high. You get that first hit, and you want to go back to it again and again. And I was thinking about that, how that is, in many ways, a running theme throughout this entire book, because it's not only about drugs. It's about the first time you see somebody and you feel something that you've never felt before, wanting to recreate that in other relationships. It could even be, I was thinking about this the other day, sometimes I might want a taco or you know, something that's not good for me, meaty and cheesy, and I'll eat it even sometimes when I'm not enjoying it, because I'm trying to capture what eating something delicious was like the very, very, very first time.
And you're a photographer. And when you really see and hit something on an image and you create something, because you do Photoshop, when you Photoshop and you come up with something that you really, and you're working on that because you really want to get it just right, you're chasing the dragon.
Yeah.
And when we're writing.
When we're writing poetry or writing stories.
We're chasing the dragon. We're chasing an idea that we can catch the monster that haunts us. And when we catch that dragon, we can own it and we are in control. And that is a fantasy and an illusion.
And so chasing the dragon is not necessarily negative. It's how you chase the dragon.
And it's what dragon you're chasing.
Excellent. Ben, this book blew me away. I've read probably everything you've written. I read your first collection of short stories, Flowers for the Broken. I was in Modesto when that book came out. It was a Chicano bookstore, and I saw it on the shelves, and I had remembered reading an essay from you in grad school, so I bought the book, and I've read everything in between. And this, to me, is one of the most, I don't want to say honest, because all your work is honest. That's the one thing you cannot accuse you of being phony in your fiction or your poetry. But there's something just really compelling about this book, and I think it's all out there. Can you read a section from the book?
Sure.
Excellent. We're talking to Benjamin Alira Sainz about his new book, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club.
This section is from the last story in the collection called The Hurting Game. The main character who's telling the story is Al. Actually, his name is Michael. But there's a man he gets involved with, Tom, that calls him Mike Al, and then it just becomes Al. And so it's almost as if this man that loves him renames him. This man, the last time they get together, though the narrator doesn't know it's going to be the last time he's going to see him, he leaves him a note. I'll just read the note that he leaves for him. In the morning when I woke, Tom was gone. He left a note. Babe, for the past 5 years, we've been good, haven't we? There wasn't anybody else but you. Just you. First time I saw you sitting across from me at that dinner, you were talking to Susan. And there was something about you that was so beautiful and alive and perfect. The problem, of course, is that you don't know that. Maybe that's part of what makes you so beautiful. I'm sorry I'm so effed up. But we're all effed up, don't you know that? Maybe that's the key to it all. That we're all messed up, and the only way we survive is to do the love thing, you know? You told me once that you didn't do the love thing. Yeah, I think you called it the hurting game. Yeah, Al, love hurts, and you don't want to have anything to do with hurt. You don't have a choice, babe. You don't. Al, it's not love that's the hurting game. It's life. Life is the hurting game. Don't you know that, babe? Oh, babe, don't you know that?
Benjamin Alira Sainz reading from The Hurting Game, one of the stories in his new collection, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure.